Welcome to The Lob by These Football Times, the home of long-form storytelling online. Let us loop you through the ages of football. So sit back, learn, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Lob podcast from These Football Times. In anticipation of our first release of These Football Times, the magazine, which is all about the Argentine game. The first issue of the first magazine is set for September 12th, and since the topic is all Argentina, we've decided to have a very special guest tonight. Joining me here on the show is my co-host, Mr. Andrew Flint, all the way from Tiumen in Siberia. How are you? I guess it's early morning over there in Tiumen. How are you, Andrew?
Oh, I'm great, Jim. Good to be on, but early morning, but never a problem to be up early for Jim.
And our guest on this podcast he was the captain of the U.S. men's national team. He played football in Mexico. He played college football here at San Diego State. He was an original member of the Colorado Rapids when they first joined MLS back in 96. I'm very happy to welcome Mr. Marcelo Balboa. How are you, Marcelo?
I'm good, except for the mister. The mister's my dad.
Okay. We'll stick with Marcelo. How's that?
I'm fantastic. How are you guys?
I'm doing really well, you know. I'm just hanging out here in lovely Denver, Colorado, like yourself, and enjoying the last bits of summer and all that. I know that you are a proud Argentinian, well, Argentinian background yourself. I know your father played.
I'm a very proud Argentinian American, yes.
I know your father played professionally, is that right, in Argentina?
He did. He played with Comunicaciones, and then he played for River Junior, for Argentina Junior, and then he came to the United States.
Okay, and he played for Chicago, is that correct?
He played for the Chicago Mustangs, yeah.
The Chicago Mustangs.
He played with, believe it or not, with Bob Gantler, the former U.S. national team coach.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, when you were growing up, did your father teach you all about La Nuestra and the style, the Argentinian style, and the way of playing that came from Argentina?
You know, I think everybody teaches their kid from the culture they're from, you know, so my dad taught us exactly what my dad knew, what he taught, you know, what they taught him. We were very technical players. We had to be very confident on the ball. We did a lot of technical work with my dad, and that's what he taught us. He taught us to be able to keep the ball, not to kick it long, even though I was stubborn and kicked it long anyway. Because I was a center back and I wasn't as skilled as my brother, but yeah, we watched Argentine soccer. We listened to it on the radio because sometimes we couldn't pick up the games from Argentina, but we could pick up the radio, so we would hear the games on radio. So yeah, he taught us the Argentine way.
That's great. So, your brother. Tell me about your brother. Did he play professionally?
No. My brother and I always played up. My brother's a year and a half older than I am, so I was the fortunate one that always got to play against older players that made me better. He was a very skillful player. He was a midfielder like my dad. My dad played attacking defensive midfielder in that role, and that's the role my brother took on. He was very good. Keeping the ball was very hard. He's about 5'9". He was stocky. He was very hard to knock off the ball. He could see the game probably a second or two before most kids back when we played could see the game. Unfortunately for him, he just didn't had everything else, but sometimes you don't have the heart for it. You have everything else, but you don't have that heart, that aggressive, that passion that you had. I was the one who had a little bit more of the passion for the game of soccer. I wasn't as skilled, I wasn't as talented as my brother, but I did everything else he wasn't willing to do, and that was the difference. My dad would make it to us all the time. He would say, if I built a wall 10 feet high and 10 feet or 50 feet wide, my brother would go around the wall to go get the ball. I was the donkey that would run through the wall as quick as I could to get the ball to the other side. So, and not in a negative way, but in just trying to show that I was the aggressive one. I didn't have a problem heading a ball if it was coming full speed. I love tackling people, but the part that I lacked was the part that my brother succeeded in, and that's being able to play better with the feet than I was.
Gotcha. Andrew?
Yeah, Marcelo, just you mentioned your brother playing football. I have an older brother too. We weren't remotely at your level, obviously, but the competitive nature that you mentioned, why do you think you did become more competitive than your brother? Is it just simply because you were the younger brother, you felt you had to prove yourself?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think a lot of people ask that kind of question. I think if you look at siblings, the younger one is always the one that seems to be sometimes a little bit more aggressive. He wants to be the one who is better than his brother. What drove me is I wanted to be better than my brother. I hated when my brother would beat me when we played one-on-one and we did things. So it always drove me to be better. But I also told myself when I was a kid that I knew my dad played professional soccer. And I knew that I wanted to be better than him. My goal was to be better than my dad. And my goal was to be better than my brother. That's what drove me. And my brother, he knew how to push my buttons. Because it was very hard to steal the ball from him. So he made sure he teased me. He made me chase him to get the ball. So a lot of things that he did in fun, as what siblings do, the rivalry made me a better player. And the older I got, the more I wanted to be better and better than him and surpass him and surpass my dad. And that's what drove me, because as a kid, people would tell me, oh, you know what? He's not going to make it. You know, I didn't play ODP here in the United States back then. That was huge. I didn't make an ODP team until I was 18. I didn't make an under 20 national team until I was 19 and a half. So I had a lot to prove when I was growing up, especially in soccer.
I mean, I'm fascinated by your background as well, in particular in, you know, how you were playing soccer back then in the States. I mean, you know, when you were growing up in, you know, in your teens and you were getting towards looking about your career, were you seen by your teammates at the time, you know, your college classmates, were you seen as an outsider, as an Argentinian, or did people see you as a US player? Was your style so different to your teammates? What was it like for you?
I was an outsider because I was an ugly kid. Let's just leave it at that. I had a Pepe Le Pew mustache. My hair was slicked back to the side. I had acne. So it wasn't like I was a great-looking kid. So I was already kind of out myself. But being a guy who played soccer, and you got to remember, I graduated in high school in 85, and we were not ousted. I'll be honest with you. In high school, we were looked upon as almost as in a star quality, because what we could do on a soccer field, we were stars. Me and my brother was a defender in high school. They threw me forward. So I was 6'1". I had a growth spurt. I could score goals. I was fast. My brother would put it over the top and outrun everybody. So it turned out to be the dynamic duo almost when we took our team into state, into the playoffs and things like that. And then from there, we were able to take the soccer, the kicking aspect of soccer and translated into football. Now we were the kickers and punters on the football team. From there, we were able to take, I don't know how we got into baseball, but we got into baseball. As an Argentine-American, my dad never played baseball, but we got into baseball. My dad was a big proponent of making sure we played every sport to make sure you were well-rounded and you knew everything. So we played basketball. We played water polo. We played baseball. We played football. You name it, we played it as kids because he wanted us to be a well-rounded athlete. To be ousted? No, I think more of the I struggled. I'll be honest with you. I struggled because when we grew up, we spoke Spanish.
Right. Yeah.
And back then, they didn't have the classes they do now for Spanish Americans. It was just, if you knew, you had to learn the language. So I struggled in high school, barely getting out of high school, because of the fact of translating everything from Spanish to English, and little by little, it flipped. Now, my English, I don't have an accent anymore, and I have an accent in Spanish. So it was probably the hardest part. The soccer and the athletic side of it came easy to me.
I mean, was there ever any doubt in your mind that soccer was going to be the sport that would come through out of all of this melee of broad sporting spectrum? Was there any risk at some, I say risk from our point of view as fans, we would have missed out on your career, but was there any danger that other sports might have taken over at any point?
You know what? I'll say this, at 14, our freshman year, my dad basically told us that we had to pick a sport. We couldn't. We played three sports in high school, so we couldn't pick us. We couldn't keep playing everything outside of school and all that stuff. So we played baseball. We played football for fun, but we played soccer all year round. And I chose soccer only because baseball didn't put a smile on my face. When I went to practice, it was just fun being there because I needed something to do to keep my mind and my body busy. Football was fun, and I think if someone would offer me a scholarship to kick a football or punt a football, I think I might have probably gone that way a little bit at the time because soccer wasn't a big – there was no future for us in soccer in 94, 95 because of the fact there was no professional league that – the national team hasn't qualified in a long time. But I go back, and the one sport that I felt comfortable in, the one sport where you can be creative, and I loved walking out on the field and going to practice, was soccer. So I took a chance. I played soccer. I made the under-20 national team at 19. So that kind of turned my head a little more. All of a sudden, I got an offer from San Diego State and UCLA to go play soccer and get a scholarship. So it kind of, you know how you just say sometimes it just falls into your lap? Soccer was right there, the scholarship. I was excelling past what people thought I could do. And all of a sudden, the door started opening little by little for me to play soccer.
Jim, do you have a perspective on, you know, as a US man, on, you know, sport development at that sort of stage, you know, the college level?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's, you know, back in the mid-90s, I mean, you know, the American landscape for professional soccer, like Marcelo said, it was pretty bleak. You know, the NASL had gone on, had been gone for quite some time, and MLS hadn't come up yet. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Marcelo, you did play in Mexico for a couple of seasons, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
I did, and back in all, and I'll refresh your memory because I played in these leagues. In the early 90s, there was a Western Soccer Alliance, which there was a semi-pro league that most of us played in while we were playing in college, almost like the USL Pro now. Mm-hmm. And in high school too, my dad, we were 17 and 18, and my dad would take us up to the hills in San Pedro at Daniels Field, and we were playing semi-pro ball there with 28 to 35, 36-year-old men every Sunday. So my dad kind of threw us into that environment already of playing with adults, playing with older people. The only thing we had in the early 90s is if you made the Olympic team and if you made the national team. And I was fortunate enough that when I graduated in 1988, we had the Olympics. And right after the Olympics, remember, you had the 90 World Cup. We qualified for the 90 World Cup. And then all of a sudden, U.S. Soccer says, well, we get the 94 World Cup, so we're going to give contracts. So we were on full-time contracts, 91 until 94, preparing for the 94 World Cup.
That's right, yeah. So that was you and Alexi, right, was playing then?
Alexi, Winalda, yeah, that group of guys that were in that that era, yeah.
Yeah, that was a fantastic
John Hart,
team.
John Hart, Pat Ramos, we had a good team.
Yeah, I think a lot of people now look back at that as kind of the good old days of the U.S. men's national team and say, you know, some people say, why can't we do that again, you know? But things are different
we
now.
What we did, and you got to remember, we didn't have a professional league. We don't have developmental academies to play. We came from our club team to into college, and from college, we went and played professional soccer with the U.S. national team. I went from playing against UCLA. 2 weeks later, I'm stepping on the field for the U.S. national team in a World Cup qualifier. So the advantages that these kids have right now is ridiculous. Between college, between developmental academy, between now, there's a 14, a 16, an 18, a 19, a 23, a 20, a full national team. The scouting that's out there in this country to look for players. And that's why I'm saying these kids right now are so fortunate to be able to have grown up in this era. Because I can tell you this, back in the old days, we didn't have these pristine fields like they do at Dick's Sporting Goods Park where these kids can play soccer. We were playing whatever field was available, half grass, half dirt, and we were playing soccer. So I think the kids now are very fortunate, and I think that's why you're seeing the soccer's changed dramatically in the last 20 years. There's no doubt about it, and it's only going to keep getting better here in the United States.
So you're working with the development now with the Rapids. What do you think of the way the MLS is in general is doing their development as compared to, say, you know, Argentina or anywhere really in the world? How would you compare what's happening in MLS?
You know, here's my problem. I don't like to compare. If you're going to compare Argentina and Brazil that have been around almost the same amount of time, I'm okay with that. But when you're gonna compare what Argentina's been doing the last 75 years and what we just started 20 years ago, there's a big difference in the gap. You know what I'm saying? So I think we're moving in the right direction. Do I think that we're near where we should be? No. Because if you take someone like Uruguay who has 3 million people and they've discovered a Forlan, they've discovered a Cavani, they discovered a Suarez, look what they're developing with 3-4 million people. We have 300 million people in the United States. So we're still lacking that part of how do we develop those players or how do we find those players and then develop those players for 300 million people here in the U.S. I think that's where, like I said, we're still behind times and we're getting there. But little by little, I think we'll close the gap.
Marcelo, I just actually had a question when you mentioned this development. This is a personal opinion of mine. I wondered what your thoughts were on this. You think in the last 5-10 years in particular, I would say, a lot of people, football fans around the world, have begun to just worship academies like La Masia in Barcelona and you know, the entire German FA's approach over the last 10-15 years, and people just absolutely worship everything they do. And I've wondered, do you think there's a little too much obsession with a development dream, a development model that we must, you know, we must have a La Masia, we must have Clairefontaine in France, we must have ultimate academies? Do you not think that actually, in many ways, it's more down to the actual personal background and motivation of the youngsters themselves. Because, I mean, you mentioned your background, how you were hungry to be competitive, and you didn't have the opportunities. Did that possibly, if anything, almost help you in a way, in that it made you prove it, it made you earn it? Do you think there's anything in that?
Yeah, you know, I think the athletes now are different than our era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if you go anywhere else around the world, a kid's playing soccer at 10, 11, 12 for one reason and one reason only, is to become a professional, because there's nothing else left for that kid. You know, I mean, everybody grows up in South America wanting to be a professional soccer player. Mm. And by the time you're 18, if you don't make it, if you don't have that hunger, that ability to work every day, you don't make it, you know. I think that the problem in a lot of places is these academy coaches don't want to lose their best players. So instead of giving them true feedback of what he needs to get better, he tells them what he wants to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make a player better. I didn't become better by a guy, my dad telling me, oh, you're doing great, don't worry about it. No, my dad fit into me. My dad bit into me. And if you look at some of the best athletes in the world, be it Tiger Woods, be it any of those athletes, they had a dad who really told them the truth that they were not good enough today. They're not this. And that's why I go back to these academies. I think they're great. I think they're wonderful. But you have to be able to get a kid at 9 and 10 years old and develop that kid all the way through. Not just handpick a kid that's 18 that you saw play somewhere else. So I'm still kind of in that up and down kind of, do the academies, no academies, do they? I think you have to play for the right coach. I think you have to play for the right club that fits your style of play. You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of academies that they just don't fit the style of play. That, listen, if they would have sent me to an English coach back then, think of back then in the 80s and 90s, all they did was play long balls. I mean, I remember, because I was 6'1", and a few teams from England were looking at me because I was big, I was strong, and I was good in the air. That's not my style. I'm good in the air. I can win head balls, but I like to play out of the back. That's where I was brought up. I don't think I would have succeeded in England because that's not my style of play. So I think every kid has to find that coach, that academy that suits what's going to develop him quicker and faster and in his style. Because, listen, we're all born with a gift. We're all born with a gift. How hard do we find that gift, and how hard do we work at that gift to develop it to the top level? It's up to each individual kid. Messi didn't become Messi. He was given a gift, but he busted his rear developing it every single day, playing to where he got, not by training three times a week. So, again, I'm a firm believer that you have to find the academy that best suits your style of play.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to hear you say that, because I actually strongly believe it. That's why I raised the question, that, you know, it's just this obsession that you can sort of dictate how your career is going to go by getting a place on. I'm not specifying US academies, I really do mean worldwide. It bores me to death hearing people rave. I mean, this is unfair, but people raving about Pep Guardiola and what a genius he is, and I don't doubt that he is. It's just people see that as almost piggybacking on his tactical genius and his faith in youth, as if, well, you play for a Pep Guardiola team and that's it, you've done it. It's like you cannot possibly ever finish your journey towards developing. And that's my opinion, and it's interesting to hear you say that.
But let's go back. Let's go to Pepe. He coached at Barcelona, best team in the world. Then he moves to Germany, the best team in Germany by far, and probably the top three team in the world, but probably top three or four teams in the world. Then he goes to Man City, which is one of the top three, four teams in the EPL. So I kind of look at it and say, you know, it must be nice to be able to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to buy players and not really have to develop them.
Well, I had this very discussion with some of my colleagues and friends on social media, and I said the same thing. I mean, you can't blame the guy. He's done brilliantly, but he has had,
100%.
You know, the you know, there's there is the opportunity. And, you know, you mentioned the academies that are springing up across the US right now, and the facilities are obviously improving vastly. So, you know, giving – there's more potential there. And I hope it – well, I hope your work at the Rapids, for example. I look forward to seeing a stylish ball-playing centre-back come out for the Rapids soon, I hope.
There you go. Yeah, you know what? Listen, that's one thing that we have here in the United States, facilities. I mean, how many teams in the world have 24 fields, one specific training field for them, and then 23 other fields that they can have for their youth team, they can have for tournaments. They have the stadium right on the same premises. You know, it's amazing what Sporting Kansas City's doing, what LA has at the StubHub, what FC Dallas has over there. So, you know, the facilities are getting better and better. And again, listen, our league will flourish a few more years down the road when you're able to pick up the Giovinco's of the world who are 27, 28 that are coming here in their prime. That's the key for us. Lampard's doing fantastic, but you're bringing in a Lampard that has 2 years left to play instead of a Giovinco who has six and is one of the best, was one of the best players over there. So listen, I think little by little we'll get better and better. And a lot of people, if you listen to a lot of the players that come here, foreign players, be it South American, be it Mexican, be it European, they all want to come to the United States, but they're waiting for the league to get better. They're waiting for the league to get bigger. And every year it's getting to that point.
Yeah, I do agree with that. You know, I still have some concerns about MLS kind of at the core of it, but those are more financial than anything. But you know, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, you know, I don't know what your financial situation was growing up, but do you have concerns that in the youth academy system that we rely so much on the pay-to-play market, and that we might be overlooking some of the better players who just can't afford to get involved in the system?
No, you know what? I think here's what I think. I think that there's a lot of academies out there, and I just joined the Rapids, so I'm not pushing the Rapids, but I'm able to pick out of 20 out of 30 something odd kids that come to try out, 40 odd kids, I get to pick 22 kids and they don't pay a dime. They don't pay a dime for the academy. The Rapids invest money into those kids to develop those kids and to see how we can develop them and make them professionals, get them to college. I think there's a lot of academies out there that and how can I say this politically correct? Let's see. I think there's a lot of academies out there that are academies to financially pay staff and probably shouldn't be academies. Was that politically correct enough?
You don't need to worry about PC with us.
Very diplomatic, Marcelo. Very diplomatic.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. I see some of the academies. There's a lot of academies in the United States. There's a few academies that you question why they have an academy. You know, when you go to a showcase and you lose 6-7-0, it's tough. For me, I think it's tough to see some of those academies. And if we're trying to build elite, here's the deal with me. If we're trying to build an elite league, then eventually we got to get to the point where all of the academies only play MLS teams. So MLS has their own league. MLS would play against each other. The 12s, the 14s, the 18s, when the full team travels, they travel with the team. They have a full schedule where they only play MLS teams. That way it forces the better players to want to go to their MLS teams. That's where I think this eventually has to go. Because right now, some of the better kids don't want to go to their MLS teams, because why drive an hour to go play for FC Dallas when I have a club that's 2 miles from my house? So I think that, for me, has to change. I would love to see MLS teams in the academy only play MLS teams They travel. They're almost treated like professionals. And I think that's the financial part we talked about. We're not there yet. But when we get there, then the better kids in Colorado will come to the Rapids, because now they're going to play against FC Dallas. They're going to play against the Galaxy. They're going to play this. And as they play, they watch the professionals play after they're done playing. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. How about we switch it up a little bit? One area that that I was interested in talking with you about was, I don't know how much you keep up with what's going on kind of in Argentina today, but I was interested in knowing maybe who's turning your eye these days when it comes to play from Argentina outside of the obvious, you know, outside of guys like Messi and Higuain and Aguero and people like that. You know, if you had if you had guys that you thought interesting coming out of that area.
You know, I you got to look at this new crop of kids, and you know, you wonder where the next Mascherano's coming from. You're wondering where a lot of the next crop of kids are coming from, because if you look at Argentina in the Olympics, wow, was that disappointing.
Yeah.
That was very disappointing. So Funes Mori is a guy who I think is good, who's a good young player. There's a few young kids coming up, but it's concerning me. I got to be honest, it's starting to concern me a little bit watching, and we've been talking about this a little bit because we watched the under-23s in the Olympics, and it's concerning because of the fact that you don't see that next star, that next crop of four or five kids that you can say, you know what, this is the next group of kids that could win a World Cup, or that could qualify for an under-20 and win a championship. So I got to be honest, I haven't seen that crop of kids, and I think that's what's concerning about Argentine soccer right now.
And do you think that's down to, because I know the FA has been having a lot of, you know, a lot of issues that have become very public recently. Do you think it's down to that?
But only issues that they brought upon themselves.
True.
You know, when Messi and the players are talking about retiring because of the way they're treated, they're talked about how mistreated they are. They talk about how the fact that certain people in the Argentine Federation have a longer hand when it comes to the appearance fees and how their pockets are laced. There's a problem. You know, so it's like anything else. Also, I think I do think a lot of the problems come from the federation and what's going on with the federation. But sometimes, you know, it needs a new regime. Sometimes the old regime doesn't want to get out because it's an easy financial service for them to work in certain places. So I think that you're getting close to that point where you need to see maybe some young guys come in and a new change in the federation.
Yeah,
it's Marcelo. I grew up in England, and my dad, as a Manchester United fan, he mentioned to me once, twice about the Estudiantes side of the 60s when they played the World Club Cup against against George Best and Bobby Charlton, and the image that a lot of English fans had of Argentinian football from that period was of just terrifying men who would just absolutely destroy you if you didn't stand toe to toe with them on the pitch. You know, I mean, it's a different era, and those players wouldn't survive nowadays. But do you think in any way we've perhaps lost just a small element within Argentinian football, perhaps, but on a more global scale too? Do you think we've lost an element of players who have that, you know, that fearless approach that, you know, today they might get a slightly too negative overview of their style, but do you think we've lost something of the, you know, the street fighting footballer today?
I think everybody likes finesse soccer. So I think a lot of the bruisers, you want to call them, I think the game and the way it's changed has taken those players away from soccer. FIFA has changed the rules, how they want to protect the technical players. They changed their tackling from behind. If you tackle, if you come in with your foot exposed, even though you get the ball first, if you get the ball and go through the guy's leg, it's an automatic red because you expose. I think the rules have changed those kind of players that can't be that aggressive anymore. Even look at Nigel Guillaume, who plays for the LA Galaxy. He went through a tackle or two that back in our era, the referee wouldn't even look twice on those tackles. He's gotten two red cards for those kind of tackles. I think the modern game has taken away that aggressive, that kind of player, and has turned everybody into, and let's be honest, everybody wants to be Ronaldo. Everybody wants to be Messi. Back in the old days, everybody wanted to be Zidane. They want to play like him. They want to control. They want to cut it. They want to put a ball 20, they want to pass a 20-yard ball in between two guys that can't touch, you know what I mean? I think the game, the modern game has changed that aggressive type of player. I couldn't play in modern soccer now because I think I would probably get thrown out of a lot of the games.
I mean, Marcel, it's, you know, I first became aware of you and your career, actually, it's going to sound odd, but playing a computer game in the 1990s, Championship Manager, and I came across, I came across your name. I promise you, I signed you for, I didn't play as Manchester United the first game, played as a different team, but, you know, I signed you, and you did very well on the game, you'll be pleased to hear.
That
era, you know, the sort of 1990s, is, in my opinion, the last era where we saw characters along those lines. But you know, your the image I have of you is of, and I don't know if you still have exactly the same, but you know, hair flowing down the back of your head. You know, you've got moustache. You're a big guy. You would have been a terrifying prospect to come up against as a striker, unless you were, you know, a big guy yourself. But you know, it's do you, when you're coaching yourself, do you try and instill a little bit of, I don't want to say aggression because it's become a negative word, but do you try and instill a bit of this? You know, don't be afraid to go into tackles, but tackle well, tackle technically, technically well. Do you try and coach a bit of that into the players that you come across?
One, I'm bald now, so I lost. No, I'm kidding.
He still has hair halfway down to his ass.
I tell you why I have hair down to my ass. Because my grandfather, before he passed away, a few years before he passed away, said to me, why would you cut your hair? He goes, one day you're not going to be able to grow your hair anymore, and it's going to stop growing. So until that point happens, leave your hair long. I said, okay. Can't go against grandfather's wishes. So,
absolutely.
You know, and 100%. And, you know what? I go back and say that I don't teach. I like to teach technical soccer. I like to play out of the back. But I'm not against long ball. I'm not against, you know, when a team puts pressure on you to put one over the top and open up the back line a little bit. Do I teach them to be dirty? No. But I do instill a strong mentality, a strong tackle, physical on the ball, and don't be afraid to get stuck in. Because if you're afraid to get stuck in, then they're going to run right through us to the midfield. So last resort as a defender is tackling when you're in the box. Midfielders, and my number six, my defensive midfielder, has to be a ball winner, has to be strong, has to be willing to sacrifice his body to win the ball. My center forward has to be willing to sacrifice himself to score goal. That's sliding, to taking the ball away from the defender, pushing the defender with shoulder to shoulder. So I do like a little bit of the physicality from all of my players, not just certain key players. Every player has to have a physical element to his game to be able to win a ball and to help us win a game.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the modern game today, I actually see a trend starting. I'd pick out N'Golo Kanté as an example of this. That, you know, defensive midfielders in the past, they had that, you know, that almost brutal element to them. But nowadays, I see it being more popular, players who can perhaps intercept, anticipate more than have to use their brute upper body strength. So, I mean, is this something? You know, I want to go back to the, you know, your Argentinian heritage and what you know of what is popular, what Argentinians naturally aspire to. Now, we mentioned across the world that technical players and Ronaldo's and Messi's is the stereotype. This is what everybody wants. But, you know, do people appreciate, you know, an intelligent ball-winning, breaking up play without needing to go into tackles? Do Argentinians aspire to this aspect of play as well?
Sure. Look at Mascherano. He's a great example of being a strong physical player. He's not afraid to get into tackles, but he's intelligent in how he does it. He doesn't. Here's the deal. You can always tell a player because of how he tackles. So does he tackle out of necessity? Does he tackle because it's there? Or is he looking to get revenge on somebody? And you can clearly see those kind of things. Mascherano's a guy who's a smaller player, but he's intimidating because he's quick, he's fast, he's not afraid to hit a guy down low, he's not afraid to get into a battle with somebody. And I think a lot of kids don't want to battle. I think they want to be the toe dancer, the tippy-toe guy that can work his way out of a paper bag, and how good do I look dribbling here? That's where you need someone to send a message, you know? That's where you need someone to send a message, and that's where someone like Mascherano comes in. You've got those kind of players that can win a ball, that can get, you know, look at Pogba. Pogba is not afraid to get stuck in. He's a quality technical player. Now he's with Man U, but he's a guy that's not afraid to tackle somebody. Those are the kind of players I think we're missing in modern soccer. Too many toe tappers and dancers.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Pogba. I can't praise Chelsea player too much on a podcast. So, a Manchester United man.
Good easy stuff, Marcelo. There, easy there.
I threw it in there. I threw a Pogba. I knew when you said Man U, I was good.
You've got my respect, Marcelo. I would go with N'Golo Kanté as the example, but
yeah. Everybody has their special players, right?
No, absolutely. Actually, I've got a slightly more personal question I wanted to ask you, Marcelo. Looking through your history of playing and the coaches you've come across, I came across Bora Milutinovic. Can you tell me just a little bit about your relationship with him? He was the U.S. national team coach, am I right?
Yeah.
In the early 90s. I came across him for an interview about 15 years ago. And I loved his personality. Was very, very open and friendly, but I didn't know much about him as a coach at the time. Could you tell me a little bit perhaps about Bora and then about perhaps other coaches that have, you know, influenced you during your career and why? And tell me a bit about Bora.
Yeah, he was awesome. My name is Bora, Biore. I am your friend. You know what, Bora? Bora changed the game of the United States. Bora changed soccer from Gansler. Gansler took it where he could take it. And then from there, Bora took it to the next level. And it was a guy who knew what he wanted. He knew his system. He knew the type of player he wanted for his team. And he wasn't afraid to cut whoever it took to get the right players on that field. But he was a guy who was he wanted a good team. It was important for him to have a good nucleus of the team. It was important for him to have a good environment in the locker room. Players that liked each other, players that got along, players that are willing to fight for each other. And that's what he built. You know, he gave us the tools to believe in ourselves, because when we got him, we beat Mexico 2-0. For the first time in years, in the 91 Gold Cup, the very first one where we were able to beat Mexico, and he made us believe that we can play with anybody in the world. That every team puts on their pants the same way, They put on their socks the same way. They tie their shoes the same way. The only difference was the color of the jersey. That's it. And we bought into it. We bought into slowing down the game because we would play, when I started in 88, we would go 100 miles an hour. We would get it. We would into the midfield, boom, go forward, and we would attack. And Boris slowed us down. Boris made us believe that we're going to spread the game. We're going to knock it. We're going to play a 4-4-2. We're going to be patient. We're going to knock the ball from side to side until they get tired and they stop shifting. And once they stop shifting, that's when we're going to explode and go into the hole. And little by little, you know, it started working. We started believing in it. Next thing you know, we win. We beat Mexico. We beat Honduras in the final of the Gold Cup. We're like, holy crap, what the hell's going on? All of a sudden, we get a few more. If you get a few more results before the 94 World Cup, then we go to the World Cup and we tie Switzerland. All of a sudden, then we beat Colombia. We're like, gosh, damn, you know. By that time, we all believed in how we can play. So I would say he's probably the one of the most influential coaches that we had. But I'll also say this about Bora. His practices, the beginning of it, the first 10 minutes, okay, President, one player, one ball, 10 minutes, go. And we would be on the field, one player, one ball. We would dribble around. And there were two goalkeepers. We'd finally get to play a ball into the keeper. He'd play back. But for 10 minutes, he would have us dribbling around a full-size field, chipping balls into the keeper. And there's only two keepers with 22 fellas. You don't get to chip the ball that much. So he was one of the first guys, I think, that really changed modern soccer, brought it to us and changed the way we played. So he was probably the biggest one. And then after that, you know, I think you can look at probably Mooch Marinick. And he taught me something here with the Rapids, and he taught me something a little different, you know, playing here. He taught me a little bit more patience. He taught us a little bit more humility and hard work of what we did here with Colorado, because we didn't have a great team, but he always found a way to make us work for each other. He found a way to make us successful without having great players. We had good players, but we didn't have great players. And, you know, to be able to reach a final in 97 when we didn't even make the playoffs in 96. So those were probably the two coaches. And you know, I could say my dad, but my dad coached me my whole life. And if it wasn't for my dad teaching me and sacrificing, not sleeping, coming home from work, working the graveyard shift, it taking us out after we did our homework to play soccer every day, coaching us every day, and the sacrifices that him and my mom made for us to play soccer, I wouldn't be who I am as a person, which is more important, more than a soccer player. But again, soccer is what has gotten me to live a dream that I had when I was a kid, that I wanted to play professional soccer. So every coach along the way has instilled something that I was able to pick up from him. The only one I can say that, unfortunately, I never really, you know what, I got to take that back. I even learned something from Steve Sampson. And he's the guy that sat me on the bench, took my captaincy away from the national team, sat me on the bench in 98, made me leave Mexico, because if I didn't play in MLS, I wouldn't have played in the 98 World Cup. You learn from every coach. And with that one, I learned that as a player and as a coach, the only thing we want as players is honesty. And the only thing we want to be told is the truth, of not being told different stories. As players now, we always want the truth. We don't like it, but we respect it. But you'd rather have someone tell you the truth than to tell you little lies. And then all of a sudden, a week later, 2 weeks later, those lies come out, and now you're wondering where you stand. So every coach has brought some sort of light, some sort of teaching that we can learn from.
You know, I wanted to ask you a follow-up to that, because being captain of a national team is a real honor and responsibility. And when you were named captain, you know, what was that like? What went through your head, and what, you know, what was the emotional side of that for you?
Shock was one, because with the personalities we had on that team, from Tony Meola to Caligiuri to Lexi Lawless to Tab Ramos to Eric Winalda, it made me think a lot. Why was I the captain? You know, why would they put me in a position like that? And I got to be honest, I wasn't really sure how to. I've always been a pretty quiet guy. I yell and scream on the field, but off the field, I'm pretty quiet. I keep to myself. So for me to be named as captain was a little bit of a surprise to me. But man, I tell you what, it teaches you that you have to lead by example. You have to stand up for your team. You have to be the guy that your teammates look up to. If something goes wrong, they look at the captain. You know, just like in a ship, if something goes wrong, the first thing they do is they look at the captain and see what we're going to do. And it was a lot of responsibility, and it took me a while, to be honest with you. It took me a while to embrace it. It was a big honor to be the U.S. national team captain. So it took me a little time to embrace it and to accept it. And then when I did, you know what? It was a good time. It was something that it took me a while to, okay, why would the coach pick me? Why would the players put me as captain of their team? So, a lot of questions on my part.
Which is interesting.
Yep.
Because most people,
I never got an answer. I'm just going to take it as that my teammates believe that I could lead this team and I can help maybe, you know, if something went wrong, I could be that barrier or that in between buffer.
The idea of captaincy, like Jim was saying, the, you know, the responsibility of it all. I mean, do you have a system? I mean, whether it's at the Rapids or whether it's in general, with any advice you give to youngsters nowadays. Do you have a particular system that you try and instill throughout the whole team? So, in other words, you know, taking responsibility for your actions, backing each other up, but, you know, giving extra responsibility to players. Do you think that's something that young players nowadays have enough coaching of? By that, I mean the psychological side of the game, not just the technical and tactical side of the game. How important is that for you?
I think it's important. First, I think it's important for each player to know their role, because if they don't know their role, then they can't play their position. And if they can't play their position well, then there's breakdowns in their lines, either the back line or the midfield line or the forward line. There's a breakdown. Mm. So it's important for them to know their roles and understand their roles and know their limitation in their role. So I try to instill that. I try to instill honesty. And what I mean by that is honest, hard work. Don't pass the buck. Take responsibility. When you make a mistake, it's okay. We all make mistakes. But take responsibility. Don't go looking to blame somebody else. If you lose the ball, your job is not to put your head down. Your job is to go get the ball. You're only as good as your next play. And if you put your head down now, you just eliminated one extra guy. Now we're defending with one extra guy. So there's a lot of little nuances to how you want to coach. Everybody coaches different, but aggressive defense, you have to defend aggressively. When we have the ball, you can take a little bit of a rest mentally, because we have the ball. Defensively, there's no such thing as a rest until we win the ball. And even when the ball goes out of bounds, there's no such thing as a rest, because as soon as you let your guard down like that at soccer, you can be punished. So there's a lot of little things that at 14, I've got a U14 BA team. And it's going to take time, because you have young men who are coming from different clubs who were the stars there. Now there's no such thing as a star. Now all the players are pretty much at the same level. How can you get them to play together? How can you get them to work for each other? How can you get them to believe that they can win under any circumstance? You know what I mean? So there's a lot of things that you try to instill in the kid. But the one thing that we talk about is, listen, you're the top 14 kids, and if you want to reach that U16, you've got to think to yourself, and you've got to act professional now. So my philosophy is, I take kids that are in high school, and I train them like college kids. I don't treat them like high school kids. I treat them like college kids because I'm pushing their harder. And I know college coaches that treat their kids like professionals. They train them like professionals, so they're ready for that next level. I don't want to train a 14-year-old like a 14-year-old. I want to train a 14-year-old at a 16-year-old level. That's the expectation I have for my kids every day when they step on that field.
Well, Marcel, I think that's great to hear. I mean, that's what you would hope. A lot of coaches around the world are doing right now, and I'm sure many are. I live in Russia, as Jim mentioned, and the Russian players have a major problem with taking responsibility. There's players who get banned for spending $250,000 on champagne after the Euros. A couple of players were demoted to the second team. Of course, they're promoted straight back again because that's how it works here. But anyway, Marcelo, before we go, I do actually just want to say one thing. Do you think you would still be able to pull off the bicycle kick from your goal of the season, from MLS goal of the season? Could you still do that now?
I'm gonna tell you, I can still do it. I did one last year at a Rapids. We played the Mexican Legends versus the U.S. Legends, and we played on a small goal. We played on a futsal goal, and if it's a full size goal, I hit upper 90. So yes, I can still pull off a bicycle.
Anybody who's
now,
not seen it.
Now here's the key, though. But hold on, though. I didn't say I could walk the next day, but I could pull one off. It'll take me 3 days to recover.
Anybody who's not seen it, please, I urge you, Google it, YouTube it, find Marcelo Balboa, goal of the season, MLS. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, it's a terrific goal, yeah.
Well, thank you, I appreciate it.
So,
my Lord.
So, Marcelo, it's been a real honor to have you on the show tonight. I see you often out at the park, and next time I see you, I'll stop for a second and say hi. But it really has been an honor to have you on the show,
fellas. It was my pleasure, man. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, Marcel, I'd like to thank you too. It's great to speak to somebody who's clearly so passionate about football, about soccer, I'm really fascinated by your insight into different areas around the world, but I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope the listeners will enjoy it too. But it's been an absolute pleasure for me too, so thank you.
I appreciate it. It was an honor being on your guys' podcast, and if they don't like it, they're going to listen anyway and complain, so that's fantastic. So we're good either way.
Absolutely.
That's the beauty of our sport. This is what I love about our sport. Everybody sees the game differently. Everybody sees things on the field that some other people don't see. That's why having a conversation about soccer could last for hours, because the fact that there's just so many different views on our game, that's why it makes it the most beautiful game in the world.
It is without a doubt the best and most amazing and most beautiful game in the world.
Absolutely.
All right, fellas. Well, have a great night. And I'm sure we'll chat soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much, Marcelo. And this is Jim Hart signing off for These Football Times and the Lob Podcast.